come to the summer solstice of 2014. This is the 25th presentation in a year-long excursion of the Parayana, which is a new form, a new presentation of the Great Way. And next week will be the 26th presentation, which will be the middle, the pivot of the year. The 26th and 27th will be like a double chiral pivot for the year's presentation of the Parayana, which is original. The term Parayana comes from the short sutras of the classical Buddha. And in that series, usually they were quite short, but the one called Parayana collected 16 of these short presentations together as resonances of a set. And at that early date, some 2,500 years ago, the Parayana was the discovery by the meditative resolution of the historical Buddha that one could get down to the subatomic structure of thought, that the moment of thought, a moment of thought, the atom of intelligence in the mind, in the brain, the Sanskrit word for that was a citta, or citta, citta. But that there was the ability to hone one's meditation, one's dhyana, through the sustenance of one's dana, one's sila, one's kshanti, one's virya, one's dhyana, to achieve prajna. And wisdom is being able to have one-pointedness of thought, and that rests not just on a citta, but on the citta, and the historical Buddha called that the bodhicitta, the thought of enlightenment, or the atom of atomic structure of the mind, and then went subatomic. And in the Parayana, he found that there were 16 parts, if you will, to the citta, to the bodhicitta, which was transparent, so he could see into the subatomic structure of thought. And it is possible, indeed. There he found that only 8, half of the 16, have the ability to be discursive. That is, to be able to take form in space-time. That the other 8 do not take form in space-time. So they are not discursive. They are not particles. The other 8 are particles. But those 8, other 8, always act as a wave of energy, not taking particality, not becoming discursive. So that there is always a spacing between the particles that allows for the context, the field within which thought occurs, obtains, has its being and its movement, and it is that background that is the context for being able to think clearly, that the single-pointedness in Sanskrit is called ekagrata, Ekagrata means being able to focus infinitesimally on thusness. Tibetan, thusness is ivam. And all sutras begin, thus have I heard. And in Tibetan, ivam, the thusness, is the bodhicitta of being able to see the eight parts of discursive wave and particle structure of the atom of the mind. And it is the non-discursive eight as the resonance of a set, a harmonic, within an infinite field of consciousness that then constitute the waveform of what in English translation the Tibetan calls a clear light. In particality, the carrier of the energy wave is the photon. The photon was first as a particle carrier of electromagnetic energy wave was found by Albert Einstein mathematically in 1921 in the general theory of relativity, but was not named until 1926 by Gilbert Lewis, the photon. So that light is an arbiter of the electromagnetic energy in the universe, but in the magnetoelectric spectrum of the universe, it is clear light. It is the non-discursive eightfold that is the invisible, unexpressible, unnameable, unpointedably. It does not have a there that is there. It has a there which is everywhere, and one can even find it in the high Dharma of the Hermetic tradition in the 13th century, in the 1200s, where Roger Bacon was quite refined to be able to say that in reality, the divine is the center of a circle which is infinite, and thus the center is everywhere, anywhere, outside of time. There is a classic book of Roger Bacon's called A Perspectiva, and the first, it was in Latin from the 1200s, and the first translation of it into English was done by David C. Lindberg of the University of Wisconsin, where I'm an alumni of some 5 years, back in the 50s and early 60s. And David C. Lindberg published his English translation, about 500 some pages, by Oxford University Press in 1996. Very few people have taken the time to actually read it. David C. Lindberg's library came up for sale here in the Los Angeles area a couple of years ago. A good friend of mine, one of the great rare book dealers in the world, Jeff Weber, had bought David C. Lindberg's library, and through Jeff, I was able to buy a number of Lindberg's books. No copy of his own Oxford book, and as soon as I have a couple of $100 extra, I will get a copy. It is the eightfold path that is like Murray Gell-Mann's, the eightfold structure of the quark quality of the subatomic particles in the universe, but the invisible eight are not eight so much, but they always occur, and the phrase I used to use 30 years ago when first talking about this, they do not occur as like the eight notes, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, where the octave is a sound, is a musical harmonic of the eight that can be expressed. But the eight that cannot be expressed, I came to style as intervals. They are intervals that, quote, punctuate, and in this, quote, punctuation, there is clarity in what is being discursively expressed, so that one note does not just fall into a cascade with another note, but the two notes are related together because they both interface with an interval that does not participate in their individuality, does not interfere in their resonance in a harmonic, and thus one can have not only speech, but one can have singing, one can have a poetic, one can have praise. If you know how to punctuate, especially between the particality of the syllables and being able to put some syllables together to make complex words, or that there is a word that takes the whole spectrum of this particality, like om, that syllable is a phoneme that is cosmic because om, always written with an exclamation mark, om, that it penetrates into the silence of the ineffable, of the perfection of wisdom, the prajna paramita of the context. In this, the movement is not that of walking, it's that of gliding in the sense of coursing. And so the classic way in which it was expressed early on in India, when the Mahayana first began, when the Great Way first began to get its encouragement, and the first English translation done by Edward Conze in 1962 of the Prajna Paramita Ratna Guna Samkhya Gatha. It is the, he translates it as the accumulation of precious qualities. The Prajna Paramita is wisdom perfected, the perfection of wisdom. Ratna Guna means the jewel of the fundamental characteristics of being, the gunas. In the Bhagavad Gita, there are three gunas. And the Samkhya is all of the ways, and the Gatha is the hymn of praise, the song, the hymn, the poem, the ode of praise. So I use in the learning civilization eight phases that present the eight discursive parts of an octave, the notes, as you would, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. And so as the octave rises, the second do is not a repeat of the first do, but is on one level higher, one registry more. No matter what the registry is, it is one more. It is up. And so the classic outlaw wisdom phrase is always onwards and upwards. Onwards to complete the seven notes that can be sounded on this level together And the eighth, which does not belong to what you can sound on that level, but to a new level, which then begins a new octave. And so you can have overlapping octaves. A piano has 11. Then you can really play something like Mozart. And so enlightenment is not a question of raising awareness at all. Centipedes can be aware. Deer can be enormously alert, aware. It is a question, as Kanzi translates the Prajnaparamita, Ratnaguna Samkhya Gatha, a part of it. No wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection. No bodhisattva, no thought of enlightenment either. Nowhere in them they find, in form, in feeling, will, perception, and awareness, nowhere in them they find a place to rest on. There's no rest. There's no arrival. One of Jesus's great techniques in presenting the way is, he characterized it as finding my rest. Where I rest is not mine, it's not a there, it's everywhere distributed infinitely. And so there is no rest in feeling, in will, in perception, in awareness, in form. Without a home, they wander. Bodhisattvas wander. Dharmas never hold them. Truths are not their anchors. They have set sail. Nor do they grasp at them. They use the term here in the Sanskrit, jinnah, which means victor. The jinnah's bodhi, that is the victor's awakening, enlightenment. The jinnah's bodhi, they are bound to gain. The wanderer, Srenika, in his gnosis of the truth. Srenika was not a monk. He was not a part of the Sangha. He was a wandering genius by himself, and he would from time to time come into and go out of the Sangha before the historical Buddha. And one time he realized that there is no rest in these things, and so he says to the Buddha, I will put my rest in you, the Tathagata. Tathata in Sanskrit is suchness. And gata, it's like any European word cognate with it, is gone. Gata, gone. Suchness, gone. The Tathagata is not he, but the presentation of a suchness gone, able to speak discursively because the emphasis is not on what can be specified in the notes, but the emphasis is on in between the notes, the other eight, who 30 years or so, more ago I used to call a trill. They do not occur as notes. They occur as a silent trill. And this silent trill is an infinite cascade of silence. Not a dead silence, but a fertile silence, because it gives the discursive quality of particality a context within which they can be as they are. So that there is a very, very special kind of quality. About 1,500 years after the historical Buddha lived, a brilliant yogi in India. His name was Tilopa. And Tilopa was like Srinika. He was a wild card. He was an outlaw. A yogic outlaw of immense capacity and refinement and quality. And he spoke in such a way that almost no one was able to get what he was saying, to understand what he was expressing, to finally harvest what must be there, until another genius participated with Tilopa in what he was speaking. And that other one was named Naropa. And Naropa, when he was participating with Tilopa, understood that the perfection quality had six radiants that were able to continue from the particality of eight to the trill of the invisible non-occurrence eightness of infinity. And so these six, which were the paramitas, the perfections, the first one is dana, gifting, giving, the highest charity in the Western tradition is called charity. The highest charity, wrote Moses Maimonides in the 1200s. He was a late 11, early 1200s. He was a contemporary of Roger Bacon. The highest charity is that no one knows who received and no one knows who gave. It is an open cascade of pure givingness. Another contemporary of Bacon, Roger Bacon, and Moses Maimonides was Ibn Arabi in Spain, in Andalusia, Sufi, one of the greats. So the 1200s is one of the really great centuries of high genius. If Naropa could understand that the six paramitas, the six perfections, were able to be presented or taught, as the colloquial way would be, as yogas, that there would then be the classic, and it's translated into English, in the life and teachings of Naropa, the six yogas of Naropa. The translator was Herbert Gunther was married to Ilse, and they were German, and eventually made their way to Western Canada, to a very far north, one of the farthest north cities in Canada, into Saskatoon, in the province of Saskatchewan. Saskatoon's on the Saskatoon River. At about the same time that I was in Western Canada, in the province next to Saskatchewan, a little further south in Calgary. And there was an occasion where Professor Gunther came down from Saskatoon to Calgary in the midst of winter. In fact, I think it was around the winter of solstice. And it was he gave a talk on the six yogas of Naropa. And it was a brutal night in Calgary. It was about 30 to 35 below zero. And when you would be driving to where the lecture was going to be given, it was at the University of Calgary, the exhaust plumes of the cars would be suspended in the air, white plumes everywhere. And of course, the headlights of the cars shining through all of these suspended plumes, which then were condensing into particality because it's gasoline fumes, produced rainbows. And so there was a cascade of rainbows citywide in 400,000 people city on the night that he talked about the six yogas of Naropa. That's about as good as it gets. Here is from Gunther's translation of one of Naropa's songs. This is about how Tilopa taught him, Naropa, about not paying attention to anything that you can't attend to and letting it occur. This is transcendent awareness, cognizant in itself. Beyond the path of speech, the object of no thought, I, Tilopa, have nothing at which to point, knowing this as pointing itself to itself. This quality of being attentive has its origins in the way in which I used to transform the frame of reference into the square of attention. Once you have dropped the language, the ideation, the application, the vocabulary, the grammar, the syntax, etc. Once you have gone into a kind of a meta-linguistics, the father of linguistics, Roman Jakobson, was an absolute genius, but his structure of linguistics was not based upon academic. He was from St. Petersburg, from Leningrad, and his friends were like the poet Mayakovsky and so forth, and so he grew up as sort of this highfalutin, intelligent bohemian in Russia, and eventually made his way to the United States and taught, then founded the Department of Linguistics. And these Harvard-type qualities eventually led to his collected works being published in 9 huge red volumes. I have a set, very rare. Only if you knew what was going on in the world, would you even know that such a thing was, and what it was. And read it. One of his, Roman Jacobson's great triumphs, his wife did a series of interviews of him called Dialogues, which I use in The Learning Civilization, in one of the 8 phases. He named that sound in its syllabetic subatomic structure, the phoneme, is the way in which an analytic of language can proceed. Because once you have the subatomic particles that you can not just identify, but that you can attend to, that you can put within the square of attention, that square of attention has a chiral quality to it. If you do a diagonal through the square of attention, you get 2 Pythagorean right angle triangles that have the same hypotenuse. So they are pivotal on the diameter of the hypotenuse, and the square then becomes an analytic tool par excellence. Because now one has the ability to do a differential geometry, not just a Euclidean geometry, but a differential geometry. Because they're not just angles. In geometry, an angle is just 1/4 of the crosshatch within the frame of reference. Usually the upper right corner. But in differential geometry, you have a diagonal that brings in the entire square of attention so that one can attend to what can be specified in particality, but also not be aware of, but be consciously participant with what is non-discursive in that magnetic, magneto-electric field. This is called high dharma. One of the qualities of this language comes from a book that was written by the man who took the way of Jesus to India in 41 AD, and his name was Thomas, venerably Saint Thomas. And the gospel, according to Thomas, was excerpted, kicked out, booted from the New Testament, where it was one of the constituent original gospels, in the first century AD. Almost as soon as Thomas left for India, he left for India with his very close good friend, Saint Matthew. Because Matthew and Thomas and Philip were the three who were able to listen to Jesus, not just to what he was saying, but what he was saying on the level of subatomic phonemes, the very syllables, so that they could also appreciate the quality of what couldn't be included in that kind of particality, subatomic, analytic, but that the spaces in between were part of the cosmic infinite field of vision. And with that kind of vision, language now becomes song. It has its own musicality, its own poetic, and every quality of expression becomes a poetic. Even if it seems like it's prose, it's a poetic prose. Here is from the gospel, according to Thomas. Matthew was going down to Ethiopia at the same time that Thomas was going to India. So they went on the same kind of shipping down the Gulf of Aqaba to the Red Sea, all the way down the Red Sea, and shifted in Ethiopia to a port that went out to the island of Socotra, and there they waited for the special winds, like the Etesian winds and the Mediterranean, that you can go in 9 days instead of 9 weeks, all the way to Alexandria from southern Italy, from the boot of Italy. Well, you can go across the Indian Ocean, across the Arabian Sea, as it were, from Western India to Eastern Africa, from Ethiopia to India, in just a very short number of days. Instead of having to go on the coastline of the Arabian Peninsula, along the coastline of what is Gedrosia, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and so forth, all the way, one can go directly from Ethiopia to India. And you come down in the south of India. And that's how Thomas, leaving Matthew to spread the gospel in Ethiopia, Queen Candace was a descendant of the Queen of Sheba, whose son Menelik, by her and Solomon, was the inheritor of the Ark of the Covenant. And so they wanted to have the new queen, Candace, like the Old Testament queen of Sheba, that Candace learned from her caravan head, who had been in Palestine. And the Apostle Philip had come to him and said, do you know what you're reading? He'd seen him in his chariot. Reading the Hebrew in his Bible. And he said, do you know what you're reading? And he replied in Hebrew, yes, I do know what I'm reading. I can read it very well. And so Philip said to him, well, then you must know what has happened just now, that a whole new echelon has occurred just now. And he said, what is it? And Philip told him and filled him in. And so the caravan leader, tall, black Ethiopian, said, well, there's water over there. Can I not be baptized by you over there? And Philip said, yes, you certainly can. And so they went over. And so the caravan leader was the first Ethiopian, the first African, baptized by St. Philip. And so St. Matthew, because he was close to Philip and Thomas, the three of them were the ones who were there to write down the living words of Jesus, the words of the living Jesus. And so Matthew went there, and of course he brought not only his own gospel he had just finished, but he brought the gospel of Thomas as well, and he brought the gospel of Philip as well. And that's how they turned up later on in the cache of documents in Egypt that became the Nag Hammadi find. And later on, when Pentheus in Alexandria found that there was no good translation, edition of the Gospel of Matthew had been messed with already by 150 AD, already unrecognizable because it didn't have the tone that opened to infinity. There was no rest in it. And so Pentheus made his way to India, to South India. He knew there would have been a basic text of Matthew untampered with there, and he found it and made a copy and brought it back to Alexandria and founded the catechetical school. And among his first students was Clement of Alexandria. We'll come back after a short break, but you can see that it's a cascade of perfection of wisdom. In a little bit, we'll continue. Let's come back to our cascading of the presentation. A hiatus like this is creative and does not interfere with the cascading of the expressiveness. This is a prayer wheel from Tibet. This particular one is made by the Buddha's family, the Sakya clan. I was fortunate enough to have a quality of being able to befriend a number of very interesting, high-powered Asian teachers and friends. Most of them were on level of friends. And one of them was Thich Nhat Hanh. And this is one of his books, Zen Philosophy, Zen Practice. And it's inscribed to Mr. Roger Weir, Best Wishes for Bodhisattva Works. Another one by him is Buddhism and Zen in Vietnam, and so forth. He had come to the United States in 1964 because the Vietnam War at that time was drawing to a kind of a closure because it had been going on with the French in Indochina for years on end. And before that, it had gone on because of the great turmoil that had happened in China and came to some kind of a conclusion in 1949 with the establishment of Mao Zedong's Red China and the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek going to Taiwan. But all of that left Vietnam into a mess, a phantasmagoria. Tianan's father was a head monk, Buddhist monk in Saigon. And at 14, Tianan himself entered into the Sangha. And so he was like multiple generations. The father was killed. Tianan finally left to study abroad ended up coming here to UCLA to be a guest professor. And sometime at the end of the Vietnam War for the American involvement, in the early 1970s, there was a gathering of all of the guns that were collected in all the Buddhist monasteries in the Saigon area of Vietnam, and they were melted down, and two peace bells were made, identical twin pairs. And they were sent to Tiananmen here in Los Angeles. By that time, he had founded the University of Oriental Studies and the Vietnamese Buddhist temple sanctuary, had brought in all of the different kinds of Buddhism, not only from the Theravada, the old school, but also the Mahayana, the new school, and they all were radiance around Tiananmen. And one of the temple bells was put into a beautiful structure in the garden of his temple complex. He kept buying houses. He would get contributions, he would buy another old house. Pretty soon he had about 7 or 8 old houses along his street and then on other streets and so forth. It was an area of Los Angeles, Maizumi Roshi Zen Center, LA, was in the neighborhood. And in this temple bell garden, the complement was put at the entrance to the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, in San Pedro, on a rise. And I understand from Stan here, my longtime friend, that they have rebuilt the structure that holds that temple bell at the entrance to the harbors of Los Angeles, Long Beach, one of the biggest harbors in the world. And it's conspicuous. The temple bell garden was a place I was going to move my Bodhisattva bookstore from Pico near Bundy, which I had founded when I came down from Canada in 1975. And not just a bookstore, but a center. I brought in a high lama like Karma Tinley from Toronto, who I knew Canadian-wise, and gave 10 days of talks on the Tibetan language, on the high dharma, on the Karmapa lineage, out of which came a book, The 16 Karmapas. Karma Tinley Rinpoche was a physician in the Kargyupa tradition, but he was also a high dharma teacher. And eventually, because of a death in the Sakya tradition, very, very esoteric, the Gelugpa, the Nyingma, the Kargyupa, all are, he once said, they're like candles being lit from another candle. The flame carries, but the Sakya is like a cascade of water in a waterfall. You can't tell one drop from another. And he is today, approaching 80, the head lama for the Sakya sect of Vajrayana Buddhism in the world. I was going to open the Bodhisattva bookstore in the Temple Bell Garden under Tiananmen and many other Buddhists that I knew. And just a couple of nights before, a saboteur came and burnt that whole structure. I had just oiled the structure with the Sakya descendant who gave me this prayer wheel and a young Sri Lankan monk named Piyananda, who founded the Dharma Vijaya Vihara on Crenshaw near Venice Boulevard here in Los Angeles. And the three of us had just finished oiling the entire structure, and so it caught fire right away and the entire thing burnt down, leaving the temple bell in a pile of ashes. So Tian'an. And Karma Thinley both said, it is time for you to go to the alternative, which was to open your bookstore, not to open your bookstore, but to finish buying a bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard, which I bought, which was a little bookstore right next to the big original Pickwick bookstore. And I was there for about 4 years. It is a quality of this high Dharma that attends not only to what can be expressed in the phonemes, in the words, in the discursive language, but in a poetic of it, where the ineffable is the pausing in the breathing. And if you go into a prana yoga, there is a breathing in and then a breathing out. Between the breathing in is a pause, and after the breathing out, there's a pause. If you're really articulate, those two pauses are open doors to the infinite field of consciousness. The way then that language shifts from a rhetorical structure of designation and meaning to a poetic where the meaning of meaning is ineffable and one can revisit it like a prayer wheel. Om Mani Padme Hum, again and again. It's not a repetition. It is the soundlessness of hail to the jewel in the lotus, the Samkhya Gatha of the Ratna Gunas in the Prajna Paramita. And so when one comes to understand, there is a quality that is mysterious, because the Theravada giving way to the Mahayana because of St. Thomas going to India and bringing with him the new way. The way not only of Jesus, but the way of Jesus in Alexandria and Mary Magdalene. A shared presence, origin. And it isn't so much that one is just married in that sharing presence, but there is a spiritual marriage in that. But there is also a preparation where you are welcomed into the community family, the community as family. And that performance, that ritual, is baptism. And in the baptism of the Mahayana, it was the ability to hear in between the breaths, not just in between the lines, but in between the breaths, so that one had the participation of coursing in the language, not just hearing, but having the both ears to hear the spaces that are eloquent but not articulate. And it is this quality then that when the Vajrayana came into being, where Tilopa, making sure that Naropa would understand by not putting theirs where there is, no is's, that you could be. And so when he was passing a great translator from India, his name was Marpa the translator, a married lama who had a very tough beautiful wife who was very compassionate and very tough with Marfa. Marpa was the teacher of Milarepa. So that in between Tilopa Naropa and Marpa Milarepa, yogas of based through Marpa and ritual ceremony of baptism, because it's by baptism that one heard to come into a community where a spiritual family is possible, where a spiritual aspect of marriage is possible, where a spiritual aspect of friendship is possible, not only on the scale, certainly not of individuals, but on the scale of personals, tuning and sharing. And because it's in an species that is cosmic, here's a galactic system. It's called the cotton. When Thomas, in his gospel, had two parts, he says at the beginning very clearly that these are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke, and Didymus, Judas, Thomas wrote. Didymus meant in Greek twin. Not that he was a twin of Jesus, but that he was tuned to that ineffable chiral pairing. And he said, Jesus said, whoever finds the explanation of these words will not taste death. The translation into English here of explanation is of the Greek word hermeneia. Hermeneia is not explanation. Commentaries on the highest level. Hermeneutics. All of it coming from hermetic, from Hermes, as the psychopomp, as the guide of souls after death into rebirth. It is the way in which the ineffable aerates the breath, so that it isn't just breathing air, but it is breathing prana. And when one uses a yogic deep technique called pranayama, which is prananama put together in a contraction, the prananama is using that secret infinite breath to language so that the name becomes something real. And the first person in the Bible to be able to name things is Adam. He's the atomic structure of the species. Adam, who when he names, what he names, as he names from this comprehension, and it is real. It's not a moniker. It's not what it's called. It's what it is really. What's in a name? It can be real. This quality, Thomas records, in two exemplars where Mary said to Jesus, "Whom are thy disciples?" Matithis means learners. They aren't disciples. Who are your learners? Who's learning? And she says, "Whom are thy learners like?" And he said, "They are like little children who have installed themselves in a field which is not theirs. When the owners of the field come, they will say, 'Release us to our field.' They take off their clothes before them to release it to the field, to them, to give back their field to them. Therefore, I say, if the Lord of the house knows that the thief is coming, he will stay awake before he comes and will not let him dig through into his house of his kingdom to carry away the goods." This is how the Vajrayana was passed on from Tilopa to Naropa to Marpa to Milarepa to an incredible genius named Gampopa, who was a master of all the sutras, of all of the tikkas, of all of the writings, and yet he couldn't enter into the field. He couldn't have the pivotal rest. So he went to study with Milarepa, whose monastery was on Mount Everest. He was so huge in capacity that his temple was Mount Everest. It can be that scale and more. Gampopa went for years and then finally began to have a series of dreams, and each time the dreams became more intense, more grandiose, more packed, complex. Finally, he woke Milarepa in the middle of the night and he said, "I'm having these dreams. Well, tell me your dreams." And he told him the dreams, and Milarepa nodded and then said, "Go back to sleep." And night after night, he began to wake him up, and each time Milarepa said, "No, go back to sleep." Finally, Milarepa got a night's sleep, and Gampopa, dejected, was preparing to leave because he'd had no dream at all. And Milarepa smiled. Years later, Gampopa heard that Milarepa had died, and that his chance for enlightenment was gone. And he sighed deeply, and he went out his door, and the entire valley was filled with about 5,000 yogis studying under Gampopa, the techniques of Milarepa, that he had been past the high Dharma and didn't know it, because it's not knowable. There's no gnosis for the high Dharma. There's a gnosis about truth, but not wisdom. There's no gnosis for wisdom. The Gnostics are half right, which means they're half wrong also. Forget it. Yeah, the transgression is not that the Gnostic myth is so wrong, the myth of Sophia, it's that it's only half right. Sophia has a shared presence pairing yet to occur. It is a quality where Thomas, at the very end of his gospel, says, "Simon Peter said to them," because Mary and Jesus were together, and Simon Peter comes in. He was like a burly truck driver type character, fisherman in the most graphic sense. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary go out from among us, because women are not worthy of the life." Jesus said to him, "See, I shall lead her, so that I will make her male, that she too may become a living spirit." The Greek word is pneuma. Not that she will become a man or a male, but just as males become pneuma, spirits, she will become a spirit. Resembling you males, because there's no difference in the spirit between male and female. They are both and all capable of being in. Registry a high dharma quality of our species. And all aliens may come here and mess with Homo sapiens, even Homo sapiens sapiens, but there's no messing with Homo sapiens stellaris. We're as capable as anyone of being the teachers. And so listen up. It's not just a Marine Corps saying. It goes for all and every so-called alien. To what are you alien to? There's nothing to hear. The quality of Mary Magdalene comes through in her odes of Solomon. And here reprinted is, after almost 40 years, James H. Charlesworth's translation of the Odes of Solomon. He doesn't know they're by Mary Magdalene. Nobody does but me. And she, and Jesus, and Thomas, and so forth. This was republished by an old friend of mine, John Wyff, and his partner. And John Wyff owns the Archives Bookstore. It's in Pasadena, up on West Washington Avenue. I bought books there for decades. And it is published in 2009, because this is the 100th anniversary of the discovery of the Odes of Solomon. English Celtic academic named Rendell Harris, with the initial J, J. Rendell Harris. And he was a specialist in languages, Hebrew, Syriac, etc. And he was in his study in Manchester, and he had a few hours, and he was looking at the stacks of manuscripts on a shelf that had not been looked at and dealt with, and he went over to one stack, sheaf of manuscript, and he read one, and he recognized that he had just read that particular hymn, that particular ode, in a book. And he went over and found right. And the Pistis Sophia is spiritual dialogues. It's the dialogues of those in the community of the blessed, in the high dharma species of mankind, and who are asking, like in the Gospel of Thomas, of Jesus, of various things. And Jesus is giving them a chance to make a hermeneia, an in-depth understanding in a high dharma, breathless way, the meaning inside the subatomic structure of that language, and most of what is being used are the Psalms of David, the Psalms of King David, the royal Psalms very frequently. And they would give the hermeneia of this, and Jesus would then approve and go on, and the next person would come in. And five times in the Pista Sophia, because all the sources are cited, Odes of Solomon are cited five times, five different odes. And Rendell Harris realized the manuscript he had contained almost all of the 42 Odes of Solomon. And in 1909, he published, I have a copy I'll bring in next week, a little hardcover of a selection right away of the Odes of Solomon, the earliest Christian hymnal. That these are hymns before there's a Christianity. These are hymns from the communities of the Spirit gathered around the living Jesus. Here is one of them. This is Ode 16. Charlesworth has put a title on this for this edition. My work is the Lord's Psalm, as a title in the odes. They're just numbered. As the work of the plowman is the plowshare, and the work of the helmsman is the steering of the ship, so my work is the psalm of the Lord and his praises. I write the poetic to carry the sharing. In his praises are my art and my service, because his love has nourished my heart, and his fruits he poured unto my lips. Now you can speak, not just the truth, but in high dharma. For my love is the Lord, hence I shall sing to him. For I am strengthened in his praises, and I have faith in him. I shall open my mouth, and his spirit shall speak through me the glorious praise of the Lord and his beauty, the work of his hands and the service of his fingers, for the multitude of his mercies and the strength of his word. And the word of the Lord investigates the invisible and perceives his thought, for the eye sees his works and the ear hears his thought. As the Vajrayana came into being of the Mahayana, Tilopa had a very esoteric document that for the very first time was printed in Sanskrit. It had never been printed before because the manuscripts, high Dharma manuscripts, are very rare. There's no corporation, there's no academician troth by which they were preserved. And in 1941, this was published in Baroda, the Maharaja, the Gaiwak's Oriental series, published it in 1941, actually had been started in 1936 by this young, beautiful, intellectual genius. And it was translated into English by him, started to be Mario Carelli. Carelli was a student of Giuseppe Tucci, who was the great, masterful high Dharma teacher in Italy at the time. The translation was interfered with because Italy became fascist under Mussolini, and nothing was able to be done. Canelli was jailed along with other people, not because they were fascists, but because they were anti-fascists. And so finally in 1941, it was published in the treatise by Naropa, Seiko Dissa Tika. A Tika is a short commentary. A Sekodisa is baptism. It is Naropa's presentation of tantric baptism with its commentary. How does a baptism get into the Vajrayana when 1,000 years have gone by between Naropa and St. Thomas? You're going to have to come next week to find out. That's all, folks.